Woohoo! Welcome to the Somewhere Called Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
It's Wednesday?
Wednesday! Why is it Wednesday?
Freaking Wednesday! Why is it Wednesday? Sorry about that. That's actually my fault. We started recording a podcast yesterday and it didn't go so well, and I think that's probably on me.
So we always record on Tuesdays, and we had a false start yesterday, and a few tears yesterday, because I think the mental context that you brought into the podcast was perhaps not the best for riffing and making jokes about poop and stuff. So why did that happen? Like, what happened yesterday to lead to that situation?
Yeah, yesterday was just a little bit of a rough day for me for no apparent reason. Like, there wasn't like one motivating factor that was like, oh my gosh, like something big in my life happened. It just was one of those like very human, very rough days. Yeah. And actually we have a couple that we know that they're awesome. And they have this thing where they tell each other like what percentage they're at in life. And yesterday I was at like 5%. And that was like the battery that I had to give to running, to give to podcasting, to give to our relationship for whatever reason. And it was pretty hard.
Well, thank you so much for opening up about this. The reason I think it's really interesting is like we try to be as transparent as we possibly can, because otherwise us talking about big topics doesn't mean shit, right? And I think it's so powerful that you're going to talk about what happened a little bit. So I don't necessarily think you were at 5%. I think you started maybe at 40%, but you're just like my old Mac in that sometimes you're at 40% and all of a sudden you just shut down. And that's kind of what happened on the run yesterday that kind of kicked this whole situation off.
Similarly to your old Mac, it's probably because I just have like Nesquik baked inside of me, and potato chips baked inside of me. This is like the running David joke.
We're actually going to get to this when we talk about a little bit more about fueling. I just got a big Amazon shipment of 6 containers of Nesquik that are 33.8 ounces a piece. Each one of these is like the size of a small baby. So, you know, I am definitely a little bit Nesquiked into my capillaries right now.
The Nesquik cans actually look like paint cans, and we could paint the entire house with these Nesquik cans.
Definitely paint my arteries. Yesterday, we're out there running. You're doing a supportive workout for Tuesday. We're going to talk a little bit about weekly structure in a minute. And, you know, you were doing great. And what happened?
Actually, so I went into this workout probably about an 80% battery. I was feeling pretty good. I had coffee in my system. I was like amped and ready to go.
And you were popping off the ground. Like, it looked great.
I was going to say, I think that was actually the problem is because we're starting this new training block and I was just carrying this ferocious intensity into the workout yesterday and started to hammer the workout, started to hammer, just like progressively get faster and faster and faster. And I was like, oh my gosh, like our mantra for this training block is itty bitty bricks in the wall.
Yeah.
And here I am taking a sledgehammer to all those itty bricks with this massive training effort. And so I stopped. Yeah. Actually, and just proceeded to shuffle, walk, just kind of get back home however was possible.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of like wrong turns. When I've made a wrong turn in a race, the clock just goes to zero. Like I don't have anything all of a sudden. And that's kind of what happened when you stopped. So I kind of knew something was a little weird because we are on the warm-up and we're climbing a steep hill. And I'm just trying to like give little cues. I'm like, hey, Megan, we just hit our record on that climb. I'm like the warm-up. And then we're a little bit later. I'm like, hey, Megan, my heart rate's 162 right now, but I'm trying not to get in the way of your stoke, right? Because I'm like, well, maybe this is just that day and this is who she is and it's okay. And then we start the core part of the workout after the warm-up, which was like a 25-ish minute moderate aerobic threshold style tempo. So nothing too hard. And I looked down at my heart rate and it's 164. And I'm like, this is not going to end well up front. That being said, your butt looked great. Things look great. And then all of a sudden it was just lights out. Yeah. So what happened? So afterward, I mean, that's a tough situation. I love that you opened up about that, especially because you're such a competitor. How'd that feel?
Well, I mean, I went out there and I was like, I'm going to send it. And so when you were giving me that feedback about your heart rate being high, about your breathing, about this feeling like hard effort, I was like, oh, hell yes, I'm doing what I came out here to do. And I think that's sometimes the challenge that I have as an athlete is like my intensity and my fire burns so bright, especially at the start of a training block when I'm excited, when I'm like excited for what's to come. And when you give me a workout, I'm like, I must up that, you know, I must do better than that. I can send it harder than that. And that's actually a kind of a terrible mentality as an athlete. And it can lean to days like yesterday where like the workout just doesn't happen because it's too intense. And I mean, there's no way my body would have been physiologically able to handle that in a healthy and productive way.
That's a great point. Like, I think part of the reason you stopped was not because you had to stop. Partially, I think on your subconscious, you realized, oh, wait, I'm fucking myself up right now for no good reason. And you know that that's a big issue. It reminds me a little bit of that term mission creep, where like you start with one goal and then over time it just progressively expands to where like, you know, you might start as like a peacekeeping mission in some, you know, in Iran or something, and all of a sudden we're like in a nuclear war, and you're like, what the hell happened? And you were trying to get in a nuclear war on Mount Sinaitis yesterday.
That's actually such a great analogy for this, because I felt like the mission creep started from the very first step of the run. Like, it was fast, the very first step of the run. And you even made a comment like, oh, Megan, this is quick.
Yeah.
And it was just like fuel for that fodder. And I think it actually made me think about the idea that oftentimes, like, warm-ups help set the context of the workout. And I took that fire, that intensity into the warm-up, and it just was not productive from the start.
Yeah, maybe that's a great lesson for everyone else too, is that warm-ups are chill. Like, in the workout itself, you can put yourself out there and be a little bit vulnerable. They try to execute. Don't try to impress the watch. Like, that's never the right plan. So let's fast forward to today a little bit, because this has a good ending. We went out there and we warmed up slow as fuck today. And we went up the first hill, and Megan was just back there woohooing at the top of her lungs.
I was bringing the party to the warm-up in the way of, like, I actually had air to be able to communicate and speak, and it was delightful. You actually took the lead on the warm-up, which was great too. And yeah, I had an oops and rally day. So that's what we'll call this formally, is I felt so much better today. It was like the overall context, like my fire was still there, but I was able to simmer it a bit in a context that was much more productive for the overall training block and for the idea of, like, stacking these itty bitty bricks in the wall and much more fun.
Well, so we can't stop the oops, but we can control the rally.
Yes.
And so the oops and rally happened today. I do want to say that you absolutely fucking slayed that workout today. It was, for listeners, it was 3x5 by 1:1. So going uphill 5x1:1, 1 minute on, 1 minute off, up a very steep hill, and then running back down and doing that three times. And you almost set the all-time record on this long climb with rest breaks, which is stunning in Boulder. So, you know, it really shows that oops, that happened. You were able to rally so hard, but that didn't change the fact that yesterday kind of sucked a little bit. So when we tried to start the podcast, it might not have been the best emotional context, because you burn bright. And when that fire starts to dim, it can be tough. Or maybe even it just burns so bright that it burns you up a little bit.
It was so hard to put words together yesterday on the podcast. There's a few clips of us trying to record the podcast, and I am doing, like, I can barely speak in sentences.
Yeah.
I'm stuttering. You would ask me a question, and I would just sit here and pause and be like, I don't know. And then you would look at me like I had 10 heads. And so I just really appreciated, like, I think sometimes when a partner shows up and here my battery had dropped to 5% or just was straight turning off, and you were patient yesterday and, like, very grateful for that, and grateful that you, like, still believed in me this morning and was like, hey, Megan, we're going to get out the door and we're going to rally.
Yeah.
And I think that belief was so necessary in getting my butt out the door and being like, yeah, it's time to go.
Well, that being said, another really important thing that you did today, I thought that was really cool. It's not like you woke up and all of a sudden it was better. Like, I think sometimes when it's in that state, it's like, oh, all I need to do is get to sleep and things will be better in the morning. And we're all like that to a certain extent. I know I can be like that. But as we were driving to the workout today, I'm like, hey, Megan, let's play. And she's like, no, I am not in a playful mood right now.
I was like, I'm going to do the workout. I promise it will be fun out there, but I'm not in the mood to shake my butt. That was the exact definition I gave you.
You did say that.
Yes.
The shaking your butt test. I love that so much. But actually, you did start shaking your butt. I remember as soon as we got outside of the car, and it was snowing today, it was freezing cold. It was such a juxtaposition from yesterday. So yesterday in Boulder, it was in the mid 70s, and we were working out in our best outfits. So Megan was in a sports bra. Only two of our four nipples were showing. I'll let you guess which ones. You'd think it's like the perfect day for it. You were in like a really sexy bra yesterday. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah, this bra has like 12 different like strappy straps that come together and converge at the top, which is it's perfect for sex appeal. That's pretty much the entire function of the sports bra. It's not really supported. Unfortunately, I have small boobs, so I don't need like a ton of support there. But it does cause some interesting tan lines because it centers around the way these straps converge.
Yeah, you kind of like a sex zebra with your tan lines back there. Yeah, as I was running behind you, because I usually run behind you on these trails, I'm like, I don't necessarily think that's structurally sound. Like, I don't know of anything there. It's like if someone created a bridge that just had all of these things going off all different ends, and they're like, it's fashion. So that was interesting. And then also you got to break out the side pee yesterday, which was really topical because a listener actually emailed in about the side pee right on time. And this is the email. At the race that the listener did, the bathroom line was out of control, and then I remembered Megan's side pee recommendation from the podcast. Opened both doors of my car, and it worked like a charm. And then this athlete went on to win their race. So you are changing the world with your piss recommendation. Congrats, Megan.
I am so proud of this listener, but also very honored to be a mentor in the side short pee, the pee concept. It's awesome.
So I'm just saying, You should win the Nobel Peace Prize. Sorry.
That's really good.
Okay, thank you.
But yesterday was great. I mean, before the workout, it was awesome because I had been wearing tights and pants for many weeks. Yeah. And then this was the first time I've been back in shorts. And I was like, oh my gosh, the side pee is back. We really, though, this made me think yesterday. So impossible to do the side pee in tights and long pants because like there's just no way to, it just doesn't work. So we need to create a zipper, a side pee zipper, so that we can pull out the side pee anytime at the tights and pants.
I love that idea. What the world is missing is a taint zipper.
Right? Gross, not taint zipper. No, definitely not taint zipper. I feel like if we called it like a Kegel Watt zipper, that would be awesome. It's much more, it's powerful, it's appropriate. Also, you do need some solid Kegel Watts to be able to execute the side pee because you gotta work to control your stream. It's a delicate art.
You gotta work to control your stream. That needs to be a poster on our wall. I guess the guys do have it easier. Like for us, we can just, I call it checking the tires, right? You just get down on one knee and then act like you're looking intently at your tire. But you guys need to like have your pelvic floors in line. And your chakras and all that stuff in a perfect place. So the reason we're talking a little bit about training is this is the start of a really big training block for you. Last week, you did 70-ish miles with 14,000 feet of climbing. You absolutely rocked it. It was amazing. All focused on this itty-bitty brick concept. And, you know, I think that's really cool. But obviously, you put it up on a pedestal a little bit going into yesterday. So how are you feeling now after crushing a workout today? Like, where's your current mental state at with this this new big scary block?
Oh, thank you. Well, I think the one thing about the Oops and Rally is that it does bring out a lot of life gratitude for just like actually executing a workout. Like I had so many endorphins today because I was like, oh, I did it. And like, I wouldn't have had that sense of like, I did it if yesterday hadn't happened. And so I think Oops and Rally is a foundationally human thing. Like it happens to everyone. Like at some point, everyone's battery is going to be at 5% and mine just happened to align with workout day and podcast day, unfortunately, all at the same time. So I think there was just a lot of endorphins today and have gratitude for that. And also gratitude for like listeners that, you know, I feel comfortable sharing this and because I know like our listeners are probably one going through the same thing, but also like so supportive and awesome. But in terms of the big training block, I am super excited to shoot my shot.
Yeah.
I think it's, we've in Swap, we've often had the 3-year plan. Like I'm constantly thinking about, okay, like let's think about longevity. Let's think about consistency. Let's prioritize this 3-year plan. And now we're kind of on like a 1.5-year plan. And I'm stoked for that. It's like, it's time to go. Let's freaking do this.
Well, it's so fun to see. We got to run so many miles together last week and you're just fucking slaying, which I think put a lot of pressure on you yesterday, a lot of self-imposed pressure that fortunately I think you were able to vent that off. But why are you on like a slightly shorter plan? I mean, like that's totally counter to how we usually approach these types of training blocks.
Yeah, well, I think it's because, so I want to shoot my shot in this training block and then I want to shoot some different shots after the training block. So we have talked on here on this podcast about the idea that like, I love kids. I love babies. I would love to have kids. And so we kind of want to shoot the shot for like a year and a half in training, step up to some longer distances. And then, you know, would love to have kids after that, if that's something that's in the cards. Oh. And it's kind of, it's fun to go into a training cycle with that mentality. It's a first for me and maybe cause a little bit of an existential crisis, but it does, like overall, it feels super exciting. I feel like I'm kind of showing up to like the first day of school with a book bag that's like strapped down tight and a composition book that's blank and ready for adventures. And then also at the same time, just like shaking in my boots in terms of excitement, but also like all the different swirls of emotion that go alongside with that.
Well, I'm a little bit questionable on kids still, but I'm all in for shooting shots. So perhaps you've got me made. But you know, I think one of the things that you really emphasized and that yesterday really emphasized is this whole idea of keeping your efforts controlled. And like, what's a framework for you to approach that now that you went through today and yesterday? Because today turned into one of like, you were such a stellar workout, but you started controlled, you worked into it. Like, was there any lesson there that you're going to take in for the rest of the training block?
Well, I think for me, I've learned, I'm the sort of person that I will just like hammer my body into oblivion. Like that's what feels most natural to me. It's what feels most fun, which is so weird when I say that.
I think all athletes are like that to a certain extent. Like it doesn't feel like you're doing anything unless it hurts so bad. Actually, I heard a term yesterday that I hadn't read the research on, but I want to write an article on, called cognitive distortion. So essentially, it's the idea that we don't really remember how things are in the moment and our brain distorts it after the fact. So you can think about that on workouts. Like as you're doing this hill workout, I was reminding you during, remember this feeling. I saw someone online that mentioned, that's why people have any more, only the only reason people ever have two kids is because of that cognitive distortion. And I think you, it might be one of your ultimate superpowers, is you're able to turn off that switch right after you finish. And even in races, I imagine, probably you go down a hill and you're like, I haven't even started yet. And so that's a great superpower, but can also lead you to be like, well, I need to crush myself for it to be a valid like manifestation of progress in training, right?
100%. And so I think I've been leaning on the mantra, the idea of like dreaming big via itty bitty bricks in the wall. And that's been such a key thing. And I think that's actually why I kind of had this struggle yesterday, is because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm taking a massive sledgehammer to that wall. Like I'm destroying the wall that we were carefully building. And that's been a helpful mantra to grasp onto. And also it's exciting too, because I think like treating the body well, trying, for me, this is actually trying something different because most training cycles I have relied on these exceedingly challenging workouts, these things that are pretty hard for me. And it's fun to take this gentle, this kind approach, which is how I do with all my athletes. I'm just a little bit different in how I handle myself.
And I mean, I think it's one of the sources of your original superpowers that might've started to backfire, as a lot of our superpowers end up doing in anything. And so I think that that's the big lesson that I'm going to take away in my own athletic life too. First, just be confident about those itty bitty bricks. You know, you can like, that is where it's at, but then oops and rally, like all of these ideas that we talk about with training, with life, with relationships, it's going to be full of so many fucking oops, right? Like I do it all the time in a relationship. Even yesterday, like I was there in support of most of the time, but there were times where my ego led the way and I was just like, what the fuck? And that's okay too. Like, let's rally from that. Let's get out there and woohoo together on the trails the next day or the day after that or the week after that or whenever it is.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. And I think the other two points for me are the idea of like just keeping it fun.
Yeah.
Like I think oops and rally puts things into context that, yeah, it's so much more fun when it's fun. And like actually like having endorphins from that sense of fun is great. And then the idea too, it's like sometimes when I enter these big scary things, whether it's in running or work or relationships or like any other area in my life, I put so much pressure on it. And it's, I think there's a really awesome thing in dreaming big, but not making that the one sole identity that matters most in life. And I think that's going to be another goal for me this training cycle, is like multi-chunking identities, so that it's like I have all of these different parts of me that I'm dreaming big and are scary, but it doesn't all rely on this one thing.
I love it. Multi-chunking identities. I'm thinking some like chocolate chip fudge brownies right there. So do you want to talk a little bit about weekly structure?
Because let's do it. Yeah.
Well, Megan was saying that she was going to do a Tuesday workout, which if you know the general approach we use, that's a little different. It's a place that we started to change training structure for some athletes in the last year or so. And I think it's really relevant for how everyone structures their training. So there are two general templates we use as you're thinking about structuring your own or how it all fits together. The first is maybe the classic SWAP formulation, which is a relatively big workout on Wednesday, a long run that doubles as a workout on Saturday, and then the rest is filling in essentially with easy running and strides, some doubles, things like that. But we started to change things a little bit, and that's why you were going to do a Tuesday workout.
And I got really excited for this Tuesday workout. So our goal with this training block was to stack a little bit of stress both on Tuesday and on Thursday, with the idea being that those stressors were going to be smaller itty bitty stressors than the big Wednesday workout. And using that for me to really help build that aerobic volume under the curve, but then also too, because I'm fairly stress limited, like we've talked about the autoimmune stuff that I've had on here. And so for me, it's pretty important that we like stack stresses, but avoid these massive cortisol hits that my body just can't recover from.
Well, I love the autoimmune condition as a metaphor. I hate the autoimmune condition as a general existence that you have to deal with, but a lot of athletes are stress limited, right? It can be for a number of different reasons. It can be genetic. It can be other things. You're exceedingly talented, but then you do have this one concern. And by moving it from Tuesday being yesterday was going to be an aerobic threshold tempo. So 25 minutes at a very sustainable effort until she fucking ran into a wall, until her battery went to zero. Thursday was going to be some light one-ones on the same type of route. And Saturday was going to be a long run, has been something that we've started to do for a lot more athletes. And so as you're thinking about your training, mixing up these types of structures can be really helpful. The one thing I would emphasize is the importance then of wiping that stress slate clean. I think all athletes were a little tempted to be like, okay, it's all about stacking so many bricks all the time. And the point being, like, with your training, in that Tuesday, Thursday structure, Wednesday is going to be so chill, and Friday is going to be so chill, and Sunday is going to be so chill. And that structure can work really well for anyone because you're constantly having adaptation windows in the framework of a week.
And I think the thing about that too is, for whatever reason, in the framework of my mind, I don't view the like super, super easy days or the shuffle days as bricks.
Yeah.
But in reality, those are actually fantastic bricks. And for me, that's a big part of the training that I'm missing. So it's like, yes, the Tuesday, Thursday can be great bricks, but also so can the Wednesday and Friday.
Yeah.
The other thing about the Tuesday, Thursday structure that I think is interesting, and I'm now just realizing, is the idea that if life happens, if oops and rally happens on Tuesday, you can shift to Wednesday and then adjust and kind of plan that bigger workout on Wednesday. And it works well in those situations. It's like Tuesday, Thursday is fantastically designed around the oops and rally framework.
Well, you did so fucking good with that. And for an example, actually, I wanted to highlight what this looks like for an athlete that's training at the very top level of professional athlete performance. And this is Adam fucking Mary. I have to add the F word in the middle because Adam Mary is one of the coolest people ever. Try to follow him on Instagram if you don't. He's going to take the world by storm. And this weekend, he won the Run the Rock 50 miler in 6 hours, 41 minutes. So 7 minute, 50 second per mile pace with 8,000 feet of climbing on muddy, muddy, muddy terrain. And coolest of all, this is nearly 2 hours faster than he went a few years ago. How cool is that? 2 hours of progress to the very top level. This is like, he is a template for the types of things that can happen when you do dream big and stack up those itty bitty bricks.
It's so wild. Also, I got to see your excitement, your natural excitement for Adam on Saturday. And it was so cute and so rewarding to see just like, you're like, I believed in Adam, this was going to happen.
Yeah.
And seeing like the combination of your belief and excitement was a beautiful thing. The other thing I would say too is Adam Mary, fantastic downhill runner.
Yeah.
And I think at some point we should go into a little bit more details about his downhill prowess and essentially how you've helped him work on that over time. Because I watched him run downhill and it's like, wow, that dude has got it figured out.
Well, you know how yesterday when I was asking you a question on the podcast and it would just go silent? That's me watching Adam run downhill. We did a long run and he just like ran away from me on a downhill, and I'm really good at this stuff. And I was just like drooling. I was like unable to form words. It's like, this is a thing of art. But he's improving everything at the same time. So this week on the Tuesday, Thursday schedule, I think is really hard, really interesting. So Monday was a rest day, working directly into a hard Tuesday workout, which is an easy warm up and cool down with 8x3 minutes fast plus 5x30 second hills with a PM tread hill, which we've talked about before. So a 30 minute climb on the tread hill. Wednesday was a double of easy volume. Thursday was an easy run with 30-30 strides. So 30 seconds on, 30 seconds off, followed by a treadmill. Friday, 6 to 8 miles, very easy. Saturday, 22 miles with a tempo in there. And Sunday, 16 miles. So that's a huge amount of stress that's then spread out strategically. And so this can work if you're dealing with an autoimmune condition or you're stress limited or whatever. This can also work if you're a professional athlete trying to push the boundaries of what's possible, because it allows you to add an extra workout structure or workout stimulus in there. So it's kind of multifaceted.
What do you often do with that Thursday? So for me as a coach, when I have athletes on the Tuesday, Thursday structure, oftentimes the strides become a little bit like for Adam here, you have 10x30 second strides, which is pretty substantial. Is that, do you find yourself giving more volume in terms of strides and surges on that Thursday? Is that kind of your common approach?
So usually actually no, because I'm thinking that the big productive thing here is being able to add more aerobic intensity rather than more stride speed intensity. And you don't want to add both at the same time. That being said, a key part of what Adam did that any athlete can do is that 8x3 minute workout had strides tacked on at the end. So 30 second hills for that. And then the Thursday had some steady running followed by strides. And so you're mixing strides as a cap on what you're already doing rather than having it be the sole focus of a day. It's just putting all the stress in that one bucket at a time and then wiping it clean. So that's a little bit of a deep dive into some training theory stuff, but some really interesting things there.
I like it. I like the combos there. I'm all about combos. I feel like athletes for me, I love them as an athlete because it's like you're constantly changing it up in the middle of the workout. And also combos freaking good. They're also tasty as a food.
It's so true. So one other thing you've been focusing on that is your form. It's looking fucking beautiful. What are you doing to make the form look so good?
Okay, beautiful might be a stretch. I would say it's looking fundamentally improved. I don't know. I don't know if it's looking beautiful. I still have a little bit of my hips are a little bit tight. So I have this like arm swing that I think dates back to field hockey days. But
I don't know. I feel like you got that sex zebra vibe going on and it just all looks good to me. But your cadence has really improved. And I think that that's perhaps most evident right away. And it's really made everything else fall into place. And that's super cool. And less intense, like breakdown processes probably from that higher cadence.
The other thing too is I've been focusing on T-Rex arms, and that's something that's been really helpful. Also, I find the treadmill to be helpful too, because when I do efforts on the treadmill, it's going a set speed. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to go faster than that. And so as it's going the set speed, I focus on relaxing, like relaxing my jaw, relaxing my shoulders, relaxing my arms. And I find myself often when I'm doing efforts outdoors, cueing into that treadmill concept of like, relax the body. This is the only speed you are going to go. And it's been something that I think has been helpful for my form.
I love the idea of relax. It's like mindfulness, kind of like yoga or something. And it reminds me of listener Jay initially said to me that arm swing, isn't it supposed to be, and she's, this is her saying this. Actually, do you want to say this? The first thing, is it okay if I don't know if that's politically correct for me to say.
Oh, it's fine. So Jay was saying that the arm swing could be tits to tails, but
idea. So in other words, from your chest, from one of those two out of the four nipples we talked about, all the way back to your lower back, essentially. So like a big arm swing, that could generate more power, but it will also use more oxygen. And you do not want your arms to be using any of your precious oxygen, because arms are not the thing that drive speed unless you're purely sprinting. So maybe in the final home stretch of a race or something, or if you're a 100 meter dash, but in long distance running, you want the arms to be as passive as humanly possible.
So we talked about this tits to tails concept, and we were sitting together at the dinner table, and we were like, wait a second, it should be tits to pits, because you know, the having the arm carriage and holding them up higher makes a lot more sense. And then we're like, oh my gosh, poetry. This is like the closest we've been to poets. And I was very pumped.
So yeah, us and listener Jay coming up with tits to pits. That's the best way to think about your arm swing. And I think one of the other big things you've been focusing on that's really good for everyone is like recovery / massage / mobility. These things about when you're not running, what can you do to improve like your adaptation rates, your recovery rates, and things like that.
You said something to me that I felt was pretty key on this topic this weekend. So we were finishing up my long run, and I was about to like basically get right into the car after finishing up the long run. And you were like, Megan, like you should probably do some mobility. You should probably do some stretching. And what you said was, if running is your largest source of mobility, you have a problem there. And that's, I think about that often for myself, is like, I don't do a ton of mobility. And it's really important to work some of that end range and outside movements. That way running doesn't become the largest source. Like you can think about the idea, if running was my largest source of mobility and all of a sudden my leg goes back just a few more centimeters, a few more inches, like imagine the torque that causes in my body without my body being prepared for it.
Imagine the torque. Or the twerk. What did you say?
The twerk. It sounds a lot like twerk.
It does.
Yes.
I'm purely imagining the twerk. That sex zebra is twerking so well. I think that's really relevant, and especially important because when you're running, like as we talked about before, it is a breakdown sport. You're putting out a lot of power. Whereas when you're doing passive mobility things, it's actually very low power to controlled settings. So any potential niggle you might get in mobility is nothing compared to what you might cause in like running up a hill or in strength work or something like that, where you're doing it under a load, you know?
The other thing about finishing up a run is the idea too, we often bring a Theragun or a any sort of like vibration device to the parking lot so we can do it right after running. And the bonus, the looks that you get from people in the parking lot as you're sitting there Theragunning and twerking is, it's fantastic. People are often like, what are you doing? What's going on? Fortunately, not so much in Boulder. I think in Boulder, that's kind of a norm, but we've been to other places with our Theragun because we travel with it and people are like, what's going on?
Well, I don't know. I feel like there's some really interesting possibilities when you combine a Theragun with a tape zipper. It gives you a lot of options there. But I, you know, one thing we've talked about before, but I really want to emphasize is that the massage science is freaking wonderful. There are so many good studies on this. We don't need to go through all of them, but for a big summary, a 2019 review study in the International Journal of Medical Research analyzed 10 previous studies with 256 participants, finding performance increase, reduction in delayed onset muscle soreness, and most importantly, improved biomarkers, like across the board, especially with things like creatine kinase, if you use this after exercise. So it doesn't need to be right after, but focus on that massage element. It can be a thing that like, if you're feeling chronically tight, like I often feel that way if I don't focus on this, it's just a great stimulus that can also be kind of fun, especially if that taint zipper is just a little bit open, just a little open in the way, on the way.
I'm glad that you brought in the biomarkers, because for me too, it's like, it's always like, show me the evidence. I want to see the evidence, but there's evidence across so many different fields in terms of the benefits of percussive massage and massage. I mean, when you're talking about reducing muscle CK and lactate dehydrogenase, in addition to performance, it's like, there's a causal mechanism there.
Yeah.
And I think that's awesome. There's actually a 2014 study that looked at that over, I think it was 24 hours, 48 hours, and 72 hours, and looking at how those biomarkers change in athletes, and they were drastically reduced, which I think is super cool.
Yeah. So the big lesson is buy one of your loved ones a big vibrator this Christmas. Like, it's the perfect gift. Whether they're an athlete or not, honestly, they can just get wacky with it. So other thing you've really done great here is dealing with uncertainty. And I think that's just so relevant for every athlete as they're going through this training process.
I think I've thought about uncertainty as the idea that every single athlete goes through uncertainty. Actually, yeah. Heck, I think every single person in life goes through uncertainty. Like, you try to send it in any domain in life, and there's going to be a lot of uncertainty and a lot of struggle and chaos associated with that. So I think for me, it's about, I have these like filing cabinets that I visualize in my brain where I file these uncertain things back there. And I know they're back there. I know where they're filed, but they're not, they're not constantly coming up at the forefront of my brain all the time in ways that cause anxiety or ways that just feel like a struggle. And that's been something that's helpful.
Well, you have a better filing system than I do, because I'm guessing, like, if I had those same filing cabinets, I'd be, I think it's like kind of maybe downstairs in that corner where I have all those papers. That might be where like my birth certificate is or something like that. But yeah, I mean, that's amazing. And I think the fact that you're confronting these oops so directly and being open about them is so important, because like, that is being an athlete, is oops. The question is, what happens after oops? And, you know, I think it's so easy to idealize this process. And you're especially, I mean, yesterday was the ultimate version of that, where like, it was not only stopping on the workout, it was not being able to record a podcast where you talk to your husband, you know? And I go through that same shit all the time, but maybe not in running. You know, I do that all the time in like writing or other, my anxiety that I've talked about or anything. So thanks so much for talking about
it. Well, thanks for bringing the oops back up, because I think that's actually, oops is inevitable. Like, as an athlete, as anyone who sends it. And I think it's not about trying to prevent the oops that is the crux of this topic. It's the idea of like, can you oops and then rally and also learn from it and acknowledge it and grow from it. And I think that's like, that's where the heart of life is.
So oops is an opportunity.
Ooh, oops, I did it again.
Yeah, you did. Oh, and it's perfect timing, because Britney Spears got
free. Yeah.
Free Britney. Perfect way to end this.
Oops is free.
So we've also gotten to run tons of miles together, and this has been really interesting. I mean, I think this is interesting for a number of reasons. Like, we initially said we were going to talk about this before yesterday happened, and then yesterday happened. What an interesting test of a relationship of life. And I mean, it was not an easy day for us yesterday. And thinking about how that relates to this complicated thing we call, like, you know, human interaction, it's a lot.
That's actually, it's a really good point. I mean, we've spent, as we talked about, we ran 50 miles together last week, and that equated to a lot of time together. But I think the other thing about us as a relationship too, is that not only do we run these miles together, then we come home and record a podcast together. Then we have, you know, swap coaching together. Then we try to cook dinner, or actually just DoorDash together. And so there's these, all of these different identities that we have. And it's also about keeping those identities in silos too. Yeah. Like, I think there's a tendency for like coaching conversations, like, you know, I coach you, you coach me, for that conversation to bleed into dinner.
Yeah.
And just having this set point of like, this is dinner time. This is not coaching time, or other times.
Or to bleed into other places. Yes, exactly. Are you comfortable saying that back and forth we had last week?
Yeah. I am actually, you can.
Okay. Should I do it or should you?
You got it.
So, you know, it's one thing we've really had to work on. I think all relationships do. It's like, it's not, you're not everything for the other person all the time, right? Like, there's this mix of things that you can be and you are for yourself and others. So we're snuggling in bed, you know, whatever, you can get the picture, and we're sitting there, and Megan's just like, you know, in this, like, in this haze. So what's my workout going to be this week? And I respond, this isn't coaching time. This is snuggling time. And fortunately, we moved on and didn't talk about the workout right then. But I am curious, what was your goal there? Were you trying to get a harder workout in that moment, knowing that it would be more permissive time?
I was like, bring it on. I was like, based on what just happened, we're going to send it. But actually, for the listeners out there, I would like to add the caveat here that we have been snuggling for a long, long time. So this wasn't like we were just like starting to snuggle. This was like, we have been like chilling out now for a while.
Yeah, it's like, to earn the key to this chastity belt, you must give me 5 by 10 minute hill strides or something like that.
I was like, I sound like a crazy human when you describe this, but it was really truly like we were just about to get out of bed. So that was where it was in the context, but I 100% agree. It was snuggle time. It was not coaching time. And it was hilarious when you said that, but I think it comes back to the idea of just communicating that. Yeah. Like, I think we're really working on our communication styles between us. One, to say, like, for me yesterday to be like, hey David, I'm at 5% battery. Yeah. I am so sorry. I'm really trying. And this is the best I can do right now. And you showed up. But also in that situation, just to communicate and be like, not the time.
Well, and I think, you know, for everyone else too, athletics is intimacy. Sometimes it's with a training partner. Other times it's just with yourself. Some self-sangling that we got going on here. That sex zebra is really going down on themselves. And what I mean by that is, like, yesterday, yes, I was there with you, but you had to go through an internal journey about what that meant to you and what athletics meant to you that I'm just a fly on the wall for, right? Like, I'm just there to hopefully provide a little bit of a tailwind, but you have to go through that yourself. And I think all athletes, you end up having to get pretty intimate with your own emotions out there. And when you're talking about training partners, especially intimate, which, you know, when you do this, there's a lot of bodily fluids, like not as much as snuggling, but like almost at that level, it's pretty intense sometimes. I was thinking, we were actually listening to WAP on the way home. And when she's like, macaroni in a pot, I'm like, that's being a running partner. It's like two macaroni in a pot right there. So, I mean, you know, lots of farts, lots of interesting things going on.
My favorite actually conversation that happened was not a conversation. Yeah. So Walker Ranch, we were running last weekend and had an awesome long run together. We weren't talking very much. It was super windy out there. Like this weekend, there was just, if our next race happens in a wind tunnel, we will be well prepared.
So prepared.
So prepared. And it was quiet for a long time. And then all of a sudden you just release a string of like eight farts, but it had a quality. It had both a musical and a commutative quality to it. And I felt like you were speaking to me in sentences via your farts. It was great.
Well, you know how they say like dogs pee and it's like communicating a message? That fart was like Morse code to you. It's like, I'm okay. You're doing great. I love you. Bye. So, you know, perhaps thank you for interpreting the message as it was intended. Maybe that's the best part about being in a relationship, is you get to really understand the message behind people's flatulence.
I was like, he's telling me, he's like, dream big, Megan, itty bitty bricks in the wall. This is what the series of farts meant. But it made me think about I had this deep existential question that I think about often, and I have yet to see a good answer on it. Why is it that whenever you pass someone running, like you all of a sudden have to fart? Like you will be going, you'll be running for miles and miles, like never think about this. You'll see one person out in the trail and you're like, this is the time. This is now.
How have we never talked about this in the podcast? I think about this so much. So what happens is I'm just running and then I pass someone. I say, you're awesome. And then almost immediately, like two steps past them, it's just a big old toot. And like, why? What's going on?
It's because it's the exclamation point. It's you're awesome. And then you have to add the exclamation. It's the exact force that you need.
I wish people could see what Megan is doing with her hand motions right here. She was making that exclamation point really big. And the farts remind me. Actually, a listener sent this in saying we would love this fact. Manatees use their farts in order to swim. How cool is that?
That is so wild. There's actually an amazing quote. Can I read this on how this actually works and how this happens?
Please.
This says, several manatees with buoyancy control problems have been rescued and taken to Lowry Park Zoo in Tampa, Florida. Observers reported that such distressed manatees exhibit a lack of buoyancy control and distended caudal ends, and that they floated with their tails higher, wrote the study authors. After treatment with a laxative, the animals expelled substantial volumes of gas, regained their buoyancy control, and then exhibited normal locomotory movement.
That's amazing.
That is so amazing. So I guess the nature of it is that farts help manatees sink, and then holding it in helps them float. But it's actually it's very important to their movement patterns because they have to surface every few minutes to breathe. So like without farting, they wouldn't be able to breathe.
Interesting. So farts help them go up. And much like we are using them as afterburners on climbs, just like toot yourself to the tops of the mountains and try to be a little bit more like a manatee.
No, actually, it's the opposite.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, holding it in. It's complicated. I think holding it in helps them go up.
You know what?
If you think about buoyancy.
Fuck that. They're called sea cows. Why would we ever want to be like them in athletics? Sea cows can go, you know, whatever. I hope they go extinct.
Actually, they almost are going extinct. Don't say that.
Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, man.
They are almost an endangered species. But actually,
the
reason that they're called sea cows is because they take in an impressive amount of plant material. Yeah. So I saw somewhere that they consume up to 15% of their body weight in algae and seagrass every day, which is wild.
And I think they weigh 1,000 pounds. So
yeah, that's a lot of algae and seagrass.
That being said, I kind of admire that lifestyle and I take it back. I'm all in on the manatee train. I hope in my next life I get to come back as a manatee. Though based on karma and my last statement, I'll probably come back as like a maggot or something.
I kind of admire the lifestyle, but it's kind of horrifying. I think I've seen as a coach, sometimes athletes will come to me and they're like, Megan, I'm having substantial GI distress.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, let's go through a food diary. Let's understand what you're doing. And they are eating so many fruits and vegetables. It's just like, it's so much fiber. You actually have a great quote about the idea. You're like, I love broccoli. Broccoli is so delicious, but sometimes to me it just feels like pre-poop. And it's the idea that, like, you know, as humans, if we're consuming a ton of fruits and vegetables and fibers, sometimes it's not fantastic for the GI system on runs.
Well, and it gets back to some of our, if you listen to our science corner on fueling and training and things, one problem with being an athlete, and a great problem to have, but we need to consume a large quantity of food, a large quantity of calories. And so what might be healthy for someone that is just using their base metabolic rate and then background training might not be healthy for us if we're doubling that up, because it's like every serving of roughage gets doubled and that only can go one place. And that is, you know, the manatee style. And that's not necessarily something that's great on a run. You know, sometimes I communicate to you, dream big, go for it. And other times I communicate to you, oh, I hate myself right now. And that's not good either.
There could be different qualities to expelling gas. I think actually, though, I've seen athletes get into trouble when they combine a ton of roughage with also artificial sweeteners. Uh-huh. So things like monk fruit, stevia, like these things essentially are also designed to go right through you. That's how they work. And so we've seen a lot of athletes have GI distress from that too.
Certainly. And those are called natural sweeteners, theoretically, on packages. And it's a question, it's your body still can't absorb it. I wonder how they vary, probably just one is created in the lab and one isn't. But at the same time, all they do is grease the wheels for your digestive tract, because the reason that they're zero calorie despite being sweet is that they don't get absorbed into energy. So always super interesting to think about. Okay. Do you want to talk about the shoe saga real quick?
Let's do this. Yes. Okay.
So this is super cool. We talked about on the podcast a little bit about how much we love the Hoka Evo Speed Goat, the shoe that has been discontinued. And I think the shoe passes my big test for trail runners, which is the broken gondola test. So what I want runners to do is imagine you're at the top of a ski mountain that has one of those dirt roads that goes down super steep for 5 miles, and you have to go down it super fast. What shoe do you want? And for me, I want the Hoka Evo Speed Goat on that terrain. It'll protect my legs. It'll make me feel good. And that really passes that test. Unfortunately, they don't make them anymore. What are we supposed to do?
I am so sad they got discontinued. Actually, my test for shoes, I often don't look at who is sponsored by what shoe company. Yeah. Like if an athlete's wearing the shoe and they're sponsored, they're getting paid. So it comes with a grain of salt. But Jim Walmsley wears the Hoka Speed Goat Evo and he's done exceedingly well in them. And so I'm like, I want to be like Jim Walmsley. That's true. This is great. Yeah.
Jim Walmsley running is almost like Adam Mary running. I just get silent and think about like sex zebras. So yeah, it's been a problem. But you're getting to your last pair. So I have two more built up. So I still have a little bit of a buffer. That's a big problem that you only have a few miles left on your current pair.
It's a big problem. I just recently fell back in love with this Evo Speed Goats, and it was kind of sad at the same time. It was like loving someone and knowing that they're going to be gone in a few months.
Oh,
and that's kind of a tragic feeling. So I went on Instagram and I was like, does anyone have an Evo Speed Goat in a size 7? Yeah. And we did find one internationally through an awesome international podcast listener. They're getting shipped to us and I'm like forever grateful.
Yeah.
But I also in this process got scammed because there was a website online that showed that sells fake Hoka shoes.
Yeah.
And I went for it, gave them my credit card number, had to cancel my credit card.
The best part is this shows Megan's trust in me as a shopper or perhaps even a partner. Is I'm like, Megan, there are really no pairs. Like there's no pairs anywhere. And she's like, I found one. I ordered it within 30 seconds. And I'm like, Megan, that is so obviously a scam. And this is a quote from this website that Megan ordered from. First, it doesn't say men's shoes. It says man's shoes. And this is the quote. Thanks to the reason of COVID-19, the USPS work slowdown, the FedEx, whatever the heck is going on, we know packages might take a little bit longer to arrive. Don't worry about it. We will get the little dude to you no matter what. It just might take a really long time. And then this was all addressed to an apartment complex behind a Publix in Florida. So you got scammed so hard.
I got scammed so hard. I should have known because it said recommended for you based off of your shopping. And it gave me a picture of the Hoka Bondi in leopard print. And I should have known at that point that shoe should never be recommended for me.
But on the plus side, amazing podcast listener A, thank you A, was able to find the last few pairs in the entire world in the random store in France. So we're going through this labyrinth of, you know, international sales and intermediaries. Honestly, it might be a little bit of like, we might even get like the DEA on us with how our international shipping rates at this point, but we do have these coming for the rest of your big training block. So this has a good end. Also, Megan's credit card was protected by Bank of America. So also good for Bank of America.
Yeah, kudos to Bank of America. They were on that fast, already getting one sent my way. I'm really excited. But we had to pay big money for this because
yeah.
between the shoe cost and then the shipping cost and then paying our guy who's going to get these, it was a lot, but well worth it.
Yeah, so if anyone has some more pairs lying around, hey, you know how to find us. So do you want to talk about confidence here?
I love it. Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. So the first quick thing we have on overconfidence relates to Zillow. So I really want to start a story with this. Like, we're really into Zillow, like all people of our age in general, right? Like, you just check it because it's almost like voyeuristic. You get to see other people's houses. You get to see, like, imagine lives that you don't have. You get to fill in all of these, like, narratives around whatever overpriced house is next door.
There's something so fun about Zillow. When we were buying our house, I was getting Zillow kind of notifications that were going to my phone and then to my watch. And I kind of felt like Pavlov's dog, where I was getting this hit of dopamine every time a Zillow notification came to my watch. And I was thinking about the possibilities. Oh, would this house work for us? And when I turned that off when we bought our house, yeah. We're living in our dream house. We love it. I actually kind of had like a dopamine crash because I was like, where are my Zillow notifications? They're not coming to my watch anymore.
You just need some more Nesquik in your life. I have 6 containers that are 33 ounces, so you can get on that. But the story we want to tell is that our next door house was listed on Zillow, and we decided to like follow this process. And after a week, its Zestimate, so the algorithm that Zillow uses to price houses that then gets priced into the market, went up 200%, 240%, which is wild. So we're not going to use the exact numbers, but think about that. This algorithm, just based on the list price, maybe a few updated metrics of the house, went up what ended up being millions of dollars. And that's scary for a number of different reasons. What I thought at the time is that this is a sign of malfeasance, that someone's getting paid off. This is not just a bad algorithm. This is bad actors, because like that's why that could just send housing prices skyrocketing, because houses end up getting sold near their Zestimate, right? And this house is definitely not worth what it ended up being Zestimated at. And then we found out, actually, no, it's just a shitty, overconfident algorithm. How scary is that?
It's so scary. Well, I was thinking as this house was listed, I saw the list price and I was like, what is going on? Yeah. Is there something? I mean, the house doesn't even have air conditioning. It does have a family of foxes that we videotape frequently. But I was like, something weird must. I was like, are they selling a meth lab with their house? This is super weird. But it made me think about what were you going to say?
Oh, I was just excited about the meth lab.
Oh,
I was going to riff off that. But yeah, what were you going to say?
But I think, I mean, I was shocked. I was like, there must be something, you know, unique going on. But they understood the Zillow algorithms and that this would happen.
Yeah, maybe 20 dead bodies in the basement. Maybe there's some value in, you know, toe tags that we don't know. But, you know, what we ended up learning last week is that Zillow had a major financial shortfall. It's actually pretty unfortunate for people that work there. They laid off 25% of their employees and lost $380 million. And it's because they were using these algorithms to actually purchase houses and do a house flipping business. So they were so confident in this algorithm that they were using it in a way that like every house was getting overpriced based on where it was located, and wherever people listed it ended up kind of being what they ended up purchasing at. And that's really scary for Zillow. Also really scary for thinking about what that has done to the house market over time. If we have these algorithms that are causing Zillow to, you know, risk bankruptcy, also causing people to buy their houses at the rate that they're going for. It's like a shit stew, and I'm a little bit uncertain about what's exactly going to happen in the future.
That's a great point. And also the thing too about this overconfidence in the algorithms shit stew is it makes me think of there's a quote in statistics that all models are wrong, but some are useful.
Yeah.
And I think if you have this overconfidence in models and like are not thinking about necessarily like what are the downstream implications of having these models, that can be challenging.
Yeah, your models need to account for oops, right?
Yes. It needs to have an oops and rally.
Yeah, and with the numbers-based models, it becomes really sketchy and really concerning, especially when that uncertainty isn't built in. So that was our little story there. Be very sensitive about your Zestimates around you. Don't use those as gospel or any of those algorithms. So the flip side on major confidence is Christian Pulisic, the winger or striker, I believe. I'm not really a soccer fan.
I was going to say winger. That's a new term. I love soccer. And I was like, that's interesting, David. I like it.
Yeah. The halfback, the butt face. I don't know. So he's the superstar for U.S. soccer. We don't need to go through his details. He's like the great hope for American soccer. And U.S. soccer was going to face Mexico after years of major issues that they had. And the Mexican goalkeeper, Guillermo Ochoa, made this quote before the game. Mexico is the mirror in which the U.S. wants to see itself and wants to copy. So in other words, he's saying that the U.S. just wants to be Mexico. And I think Christian Pulisic took a little bit of offense to that.
And I was impressed with how he responded to it. So he's been injured and he's taken a lot of flack for injuries, actually, which I think is unfair. Yeah. Been, I mean, injuries are a part of sport and some people are just more genetically prone to injuries.
Especially when you're fast as fuck like he is. Like, yeah, you're just pushing your body in ways that other people never have. And he's young, so he's building up to this.
Reporters are giving him flack for injuries and fitness. I'm like, hold it. This guy is doing his best. He's awesome.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he came in late. It wasn't sure whether or not he would play because he was coming off an injury. And he came in, almost immediately scores a goal. And then from there, he lifts up his shirt and it just says man in the mirror on it.
So the best part of that, he didn't even know he was going to get into this game, yet he had the presence of mind to troll Mexico on his undershirt in like a big Sharpie in advance. And I'm like, what confidence to be like, I don't even know if I'm going to play, but I know if I do play, I'm going to score a goal. And I know if I do score a goal, I'm going to punk the shit out of Mexico. So the U.S. went on and win that game. It's a huge international breakthrough for a team that didn't even make the World Cup at the last round. So very cool. And I really admire that type of confidence. It's exactly what I want to channel.
What I was curious about was the evolution of the confidence, like whether that started, I think for a lot of people who have that confidence swag, it didn't always start like that. Like it had to start somewhere. And I wonder if, you know, at some point in life, he had to kind of compensate for not having confidence. And then this has evolved into who he is, or maybe this is the compensation we're seeing. I don't know.
I have read a little bit about him. I think this is the type of kid that at 4 years old was just like, I'm the hottest motherfucker in this recess. I think it's just kind of his personality.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
And that would be such a nice way to live life. I mean, I think there's a point in which there's like overconfidence and, point in which it borders. But having that sense of major confidence from age four would have done wonders for my life, but to I be think honest
it,
with you.
The problem is it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's true.
You know, you're going to reach whatever ceiling that you set for yourself. And the confidence kind of ends up setting that ceiling. And, you know, we see that all the time in coaching. And that's the main reason we want to talk about it is like, you know, it's something we've dealt with a little bit, but like when in athletes, what we'll see is them cut themselves down so much and almost always end up adapting to the level that they think they are. Often they'll cut themselves down. And then even after they have great races, they'll say that they suck or no one showed up or whatever it is. And it's really tragic. And just from a pure training perspective can be really disheartening for growth and really get in the way of that.
I see that all the time in training logs. And it's something to me that's so disheartening as a coach, because I see someone in their win and I'm like, holy crap, you just won a race. And they're picking apart the 10 reasons why it wasn't awesome. And you know, there's a time and place to have to like think about critical self-feedback, but it also needs to be layered in with this confidence and swag and ability to think about like what the heck you just did.
Well, it reminds me a lot of, I mean, to describe our own stories, when you used to do podcasts, like before our podcast, like if it was a big, you know, thing that even things that almost no one listened to, you would do it. You would get so nervous. You would get really nervous. And then after, we would spend 3 days just being like, you would wake up in the middle of the night and just be, oh, I messed up this answer. And like, that must have hurt. That must have been so hard.
Every interview, every public speaking event, every podcast that I've done in my life, and I've done a lot more actually recently, so I've had to adapt and I've gotten much, much better at this. But before, I would say as of 2 years ago, every event that I did like that, I would come out and just be, these are the mistakes I made.
Yeah.
They could tell I was nervous. This was not great. And then actually it's interesting, like when I would go back and watch them on video or on audio or whatever the format was, it would kind of vindicate myself. I was like, oh, actually that was okay. But in my head, I would walk out of there and be like such a disaster. I remember actually walking out of my Stanford med school interview.
Yeah.
And there was some situation, they give you all these like zinger questions. And there was one about chickens. And I had this visceral response to chickens for months because I was like, I gave the wrong answer until I got in. And I was like, okay, fine. It must've been an okay answer.
To this day, fuck chickens. Like I had fried chicken last night and I'm thinking Stanford med school, you deserve this motherfucker. It's the offset, I think, is the most fascinating part there. It's not like, oh, you did screw up in some meaningful way. Even if you did screw up, it's not a big deal. That's an oops and rally situation. But it was the opposite. Like everyone would comment, would send an email to our swap thing and it would say, oh, this has changed my life, this thing you did. And, you know, I remember it with myself, like before you dating and putting myself out there with that, like I did not have the confidence to do that. And it really like undercut my ability to almost ever have relationships. And it's like, what the fuck? Really sucks.
I'm kind of grateful for that, to be honest with you. It's like you didn't come into our relationship with a lot of relationship history. So there's no one I have to furiously stalk on Facebook or Instagram. And I'm like kind of relieved about that. But I think for me, I mean, I think it probably stems from imposter syndrome for most of my life, and then applying that to various situations and then overlapping with like specific fears, like public speaking or things like that. And the more I can free myself, I think imposter syndrome for me will always be there. It'll be in the filing cabinet in the back of my brain. But the more I can free myself from that, the more helpful it is.
Well, you do have a couple worries, first of all, in terms of relationship history. That Nesquik bunny, the bunny on the front of Nesquik, we get freaky. I'm just saying, a lot of shit goes down there. So, I mean, I think the reverse of imposter syndrome, a story that I really love is Ja'Marr Chase. So this was a player that was selected in the top 10 in the NFL draft. In the preseason this year, he had a major problem with drops. So he started dropping very easy to catch passes. This is one of those scary moments because this is when yips can come in, where you become the criticism, you become, your confidence gets sabotaged. And as soon as that happens, very routine tasks become impossible. And what I loved at the time is I read a quote from Ja'Marr Chase, and he's just like, you know, every reporter is asking this for weeks. And he's just like, you know, sometimes you just drop passes, not a big deal. And he was essentially saying, oops, and rally. And now he's having like one of the best seasons for a rookie receiver ever. And I think that's the point. Like, how do we contextualize both our valid mistakes and shortcomings and our invalid ones that our brains create into long-term growth? And that's why we want to like essentially say, confidence is not about thinking that you're perfect. Confidence is about thinking that you can oops and rally. And this is all about rallying. How can you get over the imposter syndrome? How can you do all this? Just get up the next day and rally, just like Megan did on that workout.
I absolutely love that.
Yeah. So there's a lot of really interesting science on this. There was a 1978 article in psychotherapy on imposter syndrome, where essentially people are attributing things to internal phoniness, so that even successes don't get attributed to you. And, you know, I think all of us face this a little bit. So thinking about the podcast, for example, we've talked in the past about getting 1-star reviews, and that 1-star bar is the second biggest bar. It looks so big to me. Does it look big to you?
I mean, it feels so salient. I try not to look at that stuff because it's like, I know I will internalize it.
It's like, probably just like the workout yesterday, because like the workout yesterday, you have a watch on it.
Yes.
So you have this feedback.
Yep.
Oh man. Don't look at those.
I was gonna say, the more metrics I can avoid in my life, the better, because I'm such a numbers person. I'm such a data person. And sometimes you just have to set it free and just let it believe in your brain. And it's like, yeah, I'm going to give myself a good metric.
I love that. That's so interesting. So I looked up on Apple Podcast Connect, the actual numbers. And we've had only 14 1-star reviews. It's a pretty good number, more than most, but still not that big when you compare it to 416 5-star reviews. And for some reason, those 14 1-star reviews feel so hurtful. And I mean, I think that that's probably a good metaphor for how our brains are interpreting all of the negative signals. It's like we're taking those small percentage of 1-stars and being like, blowing them up and projecting them on the biggest screen possible. And, you know, my brain is doing that all the fucking time.
Also, a very short flip side on this. I think also too, before you go and give someone a 1-star review, like think about how salient it's going to be for that person. Like I've been in situations before where I have to give critical feedback. And sometimes like if I don't count back to 5 and like really center myself before sending the feedback, it could be a 1-star review. That's not the personality type I am.
That's not you. Have never been
in your life. Yeah. My worst is probably a 3-star review. But I think though there's a lot just like having grace with that and being delicate about giving that feedback, because it can be so salient in people's brains. You have no idea. Like what if that person that you're giving it to has severe imposter syndrome? Like imagine how that could. And so I think, you know, feedback is important, but the method of doing it is also something to think about.
Yeah. And I think imposter syndrome, that's funny because it's not like a medical syndrome as far as I know, or a clinical one, but I think we all have traits like this. In a few quotes of how it might manifest in an athlete: I am just tough. I have no actual talent. I bet a lot of listeners are thinking that in their own head. That good run / race was lucky, or I wouldn't even call myself an athlete. And it's stuff we hear all the time. And that's the first thing. If you're listening to this right now, you are a fucking athlete. You are talented. You are capable of all these things. And overcoming imposter syndrome requires that you acknowledge that is your goal. Just like Megan yesterday had to acknowledge that itty bitty bricks were the goal. And if you can do that, you're on the path, even if it's going to be a long and winding path where those 1-star reviews still feel really big in your own head.
I think the other area that I've seen it in coaching is the idea that athletes, they like think their bad day is their actual reflection of fitness. And so I think part of imposter syndrome is being able to separate it apart, like what's an oops and what's a good day, or what's a bad day, what's a good day, and just having context and faith in that process.
Yeah. And I think really at the end of the day, it all comes back to fear, right? Like even thinking about your run yesterday where you know, you have to DNF it, like part of it comes back to a fear, not just a fear of like damaging yourself, but a fear of like, what if I'm not good enough? You know, it's the same workout you did the week before. What if it was slower? Like that's scary. Or podcasts like fear. What if this truly does suck? Or coaching, as when an athlete leaves, it still crushes my soul. And I'm like, well, maybe this is just because I am a bad coach for that person. And that hurts. It's so scary.
Or maybe it's even a fear of being found out that you have imposter syndrome. Yeah. Or I think, like, for me, sometimes a fear that I have with public speaking is like, what if they can tell I'm nervous?
Oh, no.
Which is ridiculous, because that's, I mean, that's ego talking. But I think a lot of fear also too is like fear surrounding judgment of self or judgment from other people, or even just like being found out in some sense about imposter syndrome.
Yeah. And so how do we confront this fear? I think that that's the big thing. Like, the podcast for us is a little bit of like therapy in some ways, because we talk about our fears as openly as we can. And I think coaching can be really helpful with that too, because we get to hear other people's fears and contextualize them. But if you don't have that, we have three tips that we think can really help.
I think as we think about the three points though, there's one big overarching point, which is the idea of embracing your talent without constantly having to evaluate yourself, or like having these metrics of self-judgment and just developing frameworks where that's possible.
Yeah, self-evaluation, I think, gets at the core of all these problems. Like, as soon as you start to turn inward and be like, am I doing enough? Am I enough? Am I, like, all these things in the moment, just, it becomes an impossible standard to reach if you're the type of person that wants to achieve at all. You know, it gets back, like, your best will never be enough unless it's always enough. And, you know, that is the main way to confront the fear, which gets to the first big point. You don't need to be the best at everything all the time. You know, and that gets, like, with running, for example, and your workout, like, you don't need to set a PR. You don't need to get a Strava crown. You don't need to do all these things. You just need to put in the effort and stack an itty bitty brick up. And that's so much easier than thinking of these big narratives that are going to be impossible to achieve every time.
And I think in some sense that does take some element of vulnerability, because like, it's involving dropping balls or quote unquote, what might feel like a failure, and being vulnerable and accepting that and realizing that's part of the growth journey, I think is valuable for that point.
I drop so many balls. Like, I think sometimes, especially the athletes that we coach are like, you're so on top of it. Like, I'll, you know, never miss anything. You're doing this all year round. And it's like, everything else is falling by the wayside. We're going to get into some of our nutrition in a few minutes, and you'll understand a little bit more of what, like, that whole world when we talk about that.
I was going to say, I think only the athletes think that haven't been to our house.
Yeah.
The athletes that have been to our house and walk into the current shit show that it is, and they fully appreciate the balls that we are dropping in other areas of life.
Balls on the floor, that's for sure. So point two is to put yourself out there with the purpose of learning. So learning being the goal of vulnerability rather than achievement. Like, learning is such a great thing to fall back on, because every oops becomes an opportunity rather than like, oh, fuck myself. Like, I'm not at this level. I'm not capable of this. I'm not whatever. I think that really ends up being important, at least for me.
And I think learning for me is a more lasting fuel for the fire. So I think achievement is this thing that it comes and goes. It's a roller coaster. Yeah. Whereas learning can be something that's kind of a pretty straight line for people. And it's something like, for me, I feel like my life is kind of a natural roller coaster, and grasping onto that straight line of learning is, it feels, I guess, powerful, but also like a sense of like enjoyment and fulfillment at the same time.
When it goes with like relationships too, you know, like, just, you don't need to have the best relationship all the time. It can go through really dark places, and that'll make it stronger, or it won't. But like, it's just a framework for whatever learning comes out of it. Or the humor in the podcast. Like,
oh, so true.
We're not comedians, like, but we're trying to make jokes all the time like we would in real life. That's vulnerable and scary. But I think what we learn in that process is like, oh, it's actually okay to do that. And we learn more about ourselves. And, you know, that vulnerability actually hopefully helps people way more than if we were some, you know, perfect light on a hill that everyone wants to emulate, and which I hope you don't.
It's a way more fun process too. And then the third point too is just that this needs to be a daily commitment. Like, I think once achievement happens, or once like certain trajectories in life happens, this can fall by the wayside.
Yeah.
And that's when it becomes even more dangerous, is because like the stakes and the odds get higher and higher. And so having an accountability partner, like, I think you are my accountability partner for this, very helpful. And we have these open and honest discussions. But then also for me, I lean on like some mantras that help, and just daily reminders. Sometimes I've even like written notes to myself for days that are tough. It's like, dear Megan, this is you in the past, and then also you in the future, just to let myself know that like it will get better.
Well, yeah, you mentioned the composition book that you take into the start of each training block, of like these big scary training blocks. I feel like each composition book, each page just needs to say like, you are awesome, you are a badass sexy bro, or whatever else you need to hear that day. Because gosh, if you do put yourself out there, like, you're going to get so many one-star reviews. You're going to kind of like hate yourself and judge yourself all the time. And that's kind of, I think, the whole point of being human and finding growth. In so many people though, what we see in coaching is they cut themselves off at like 60% of their capabilities, because stepping beyond that does require getting burned over and over and over again. It requires oops, 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 oops. Kind of like my farts, just in terms of oops. And so, you know, let's all try to embrace those oops as much as we possibly can, just like Megan did on those workouts.
I love the sound effects that you gave to the oops. That was especially for listeners listening on 1.5 speed. I imagine that sound comes off like a song. And the more oops songs, the more oops ballads we can create, I feel like the better.
Oops, we did it again. So we're going to now talk about a question we got from a ton of people after Science Corner. And this is on specific fueling tips. Listener T sent in a really long, great question. We're not going to read on this. That basically, we wanted to talk about, we're not perfect on this topic. So even though we talk about underfueling and overtraining and the importance of making sure you eat enough food, it's not like we're putting down organic nutrition all the time or anything like that. Nor do we want our athletes to.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Also too, so this particular question was kind of framed around the idea of like, what do you guys eat in a day? And I think just a cautionary tale, we're going to talk in terms of general structures and concepts. I've seen recently, so there's a lot of these, like, I don't know, these reels that are like, here's all the food I eat in the day. And sometimes they can be triggering for people because it's like, it's a metric for comparison. Whenever you see whatever else someone is eating in a day, the brain just wants to leap to logical comparison. For and sure. So we're not going to do that. We're just going to share kind of general trends and put some jokes in there along the way.
Yeah, no numbers or anything like that. But I think it'll give you an idea of like how this works. Like when we say throw as much as you can at the wall and see what sticks, that really matters. First though, a slight follow-up on the Science Corner. So I think it's really important to remember that fueling, it's about fueling the activity you're doing. And life is an activity, training is an activity and all of that. But we're not saying like, eat as much food as you can all the time, no matter who you are. Like that's obviously can lead to negative places for some people, particularly people that might have, you know, like high cholesterol or type 2 diabetes or things like that. We got a few follow-ups of people asking specific things. That's a place where you need to work with a doctor or nutritionist, I think, for maybe specific tips. But I think in a caveat that matters.
I agree. Thank you for providing that asterisk. I think developing the care team there is so important.
Yeah.
Also, interestingly too, though, this is just one really quick aside. I've seen some biomarkers in athletes that are struggling with REDS that are interesting. So actually I've seen elevated cholesterol levels quite frequently in athletes that are struggling with REDS. And that is, so recent research is backing that up with the idea that upwards of 50% of patients with anorexia nervosa do have these elevated cholesterol levels. And it's from either abnormalities in the liver or abnormalities in the thyroid or how the body is metabolizing. And also just underscores the idea of this topic of eating enough always, because it's wild to think about like cholesterol numbers skyrocketing and an athlete who's not eating enough.
Yeah. I mean, it points out the interconnectedness of all of this too and how complicated it is. And so when we're saying what we eat in a day and how it looks for us as athletes, I think it's important to remember, one, we have guessed and tested this for a long time, have very specific like appetites and things like that. And final thing, don't really know what the fuck we're doing. We're kind of making it up as we go too, but this has worked for us for the most part. So you want to get into this?
I do. Actually, I want to add one other final thing. And that's that sometimes there are other health considerations. Like since I was diagnosed with this autoimmune thing, I actually have an anti-inflammatory approach that I've taken to eating. And that's drastically changed how I eat and still have had a lot of fun in that context. Like food is still fun. Food is still rewarding, and have found ways to make substitutions to make it possible. Yeah. And so I think that's another thing too, is there's other health considerations that someone might want to consider.
A lot of people have actually emailed asking what you do specifically.
We can share that actually in an episode coming up.
And this might also be a slight intro to that topic. So we wake up around 5 a.m. Notably, we'll say we go to sleep at like 8. So it's not, we're sleeping.
Or sometimes it's, this morning was 4:30. It's early. I was ready to oops and rally this morning.
It was a little bit of 4:30 a.m. intensity today. So we wake up, we go down there and we both have breakfast. So for Megan, what do you focus on?
I wake up and within 3 minutes I'm like, food. I'm really excited for my breakfast. So I have oatmeal, I mix in peanut butter, and I put some creamer and some honey in there. The creamer that I have is, I've been focusing recently on low sugar, so it's a low sugar creamer, but it's delicious and I just really look forward to it in the mornings.
I'm the flip side though, where I come down and I'm just like housing anything that will move, but with no structure. So what I've been really into recently are these Gatorade chocolate protein bars. They are absolute crack. I'm sure maybe that's what they have buried in the basement of this house next door, because I would pay millions of dollars for those. They are so good, so delightfully unhealthy and so inflammatory, but they're delicious.
They remind me of those crunch bars that came in the blue packages, yeah. but just blown up into a quote unquote performance bar is how I picture them.
And then with my coffee, I'm using straight Coffee Mate creamer that's super sweet. I'm mixing in Nesquik. It's kind of a shit show for me, but it works really well for my running at least. So pre-exercise, we often do sports drink, like a cup of sports drink, and sometimes a gel or a caffeinated gel. Like that combo can really help during activity, I think.
It's for me, it's pretty key. I find I just, one, I'm more excited to start the workout, but two, it's also really fun to look forward to that. I would say with the anti-inflammatory stuff that I've on, I actually don't pay attention to anti-inflammatory during exercise. I was trying to do like reduce sugar, trying to do like all these different things that were anti-inflammatory during exercise and just kept bulking. So I was like, around exercise, I'm going to have gels, I'm going to have caffeine, I'm going to have all these different things that lead to performance because that's just what my body needs. Also, it might be more anti-inflammatory because I think if my body wasn't properly fueled, the inflammation processes would happen more.
Yeah, the ultimate catabolic processes are the ultimate inflammatory stimulus. So that I think has been huge for you. And then on runs themselves, on runs over 90 minutes, we'll usually do a gel around 45 minutes and then every 30 minutes after, mixing with sports drink to ideally get up to 250 or 300 calories per hour. But on runs under 90 minutes, it's a mixed bag. Megan took a gel today after the workout, but usually I won't take a gel on those types of things. And sometimes even on longer efforts, I won't take fuel if they're really low intensity, because men at some cases, 2-ish hour efforts can be like productive for fat oxidation for men, but not for women if it's unfueled.
One consideration that I have too on this topic is, what am I doing the rest of the day? So one part of the reason that I took the gel is I had to be prepared for the podcast. I had to come into this with energy. And so the caffeinated gel really does help me feel good in work later in the day. So if I have a big presentation, if I have meetings, I want my brain to be in that manuscript writing process, I take the gel, kind of on these shorter workouts, and I find it helps.
I love that so much. Well, that's a great tip actually for people that need to be productive. Instead of having coffee when you get back, have that gel halfway through your run, like the caffeinated gel, because I find that those hit so different. Like they just hit right, you know? They just hit like in this sexy form. It's so perfect. I think it's ideal.
I think it's actually probably great for adaptation too.
So post-exercise, we try to focus on hydration, ideally with calories, whether that's sports drink or other things. This is a place where Megan might have to differ a little bit, but it gets to the point of liquid calories are so important. The within day energy deficit studies that we mentioned before, like the 2017 one in the Scandinavian Journal of Sports Medicine, found that independent, influences coming from liquid calorie consumption. So athletes that took in some liquid calories didn't have the problems with overtraining and, all the health consequences that come with it. That's pretty fascinating.
It's pretty fascinating. And then for me too, I think I've loved coconut water as liquid calorie post-run. It's been fantastic. You often love Gatorade. Sometimes you'll do a Coke and you get really, you're like, I'm going to have a good work day the rest of the day after this.
And don't shy away from liquid calories is the big message there. Like if you find yourself going for a diet drink, be like, why? Why am I doing this? Make sure there's a good reason there from a doctor, because all the studies say that that can only help. And then post-run meal for us is usually our protein cereal. Whoever you are, the main idea is some sort of calorie bomb where you're giving your body a wide spectrum of things it might need. And the reason we love protein cereal is those portions are not measured. Honestly, sometimes we reflect on our box consumption and we're like, oh my goodness, that's a lot of boxes.
That actually happened to me on Monday on our rest day. So we usually buy the really big boxes.
Yeah.
And for some reason we bought a small box. I just opened it and I was just sitting there eating just enjoying my breakfast. And I realized we ate like half the box, but because it was a small box.
Yeah.
So I think if you think about serving sizes, just buy the big box. Well, you don't have any context for how much you ate.
You're mixing it with other cereals too, yes. Which is great. And that's why you're able to run, this incredible workout today. And so that's for us because it works really well. But that can be anything that really jumps out to you and you'll like, even when you might not be the hungriest at times. So then ideally lunch or a midday meal after that at some point during the day. You're pretty disciplined with this, a lot more than I am.
I love soup for the midday meal. Yeah. Lentil soup, amazing source of iron. Also good fiber, good protein. I like the saltiness of that. So after the protein cereal, having the salty, like more midday meal is something that I look forward to.
And for me, like, honestly, sometimes I just eat like a metric crap ton of nuts and bars and potato chips and things like that. Not saying that that's the way to go, but I'm often just eating throughout the day. And then definitely loading up on snacks too. Nuts and dried fruit, I think, are really great ones to have all the time. Like if you can have those in the house, then it gives you a background where you're not like me reaching for the salt and vinegar potato chips every second. Though that's good in moderation, perhaps not going through 3 bags a day, given the fact that like, you know, I want to be around to raise our kids. It's probably a good thing.
We're always stocked up on cashews, almonds, peanuts. Those are kind of our go-to nuts in this household. And then just creating fun trail mixes in the two.
Yeah. And like, for me, at least, I love the big thing of Planters peanuts that are like, you know, about the same size as my Nesquik containers. These you can just go a whole hand in there. And this is another place where you're not aware of serving sizes, which is great because you can get a lot of calories in a short period of time and not have to worry about that. So sometimes we double. This is a place where I am a lot more strategic than Megan. So I have a more sensitive stomach, I would think, than you.
I can actually, the other week, I remember I created this like salmon meal and then I doubled 30 minutes after. And you looked at me like, Megan, what are you doing?
That would be a disaster for me.
It's fantastic ultra training. Yes.
It doesn't even affect you.
No. Yeah.
Why? What's going on?
I think as a kid, I just constantly ate and then went out the door to run. Yeah. So, I mean, I would do it all the time with like cake, sandwiches, whatever. And I think my stomach is just adapted to it.
Oh man. I wish I had that at all. So I need to think a little bit more strategically. So for me, I usually don't eat within 2 hours of my doubles. And I hydrate 75 minutes out with sports drink and try to like make sure I'm not, you know, making like those manatees on the run. And then I think the biggest, most important thing for us in particular is our dinner. Because this is our insurance policy for the day. This is our fun time together. We always spend this time together. There's no devices or anything like that. There's no work. It's the end of the day. And so this is when we just load up and we try to make sure that whatever we do, dinner is not like, you know, a dainty little thing that might leave us feeling lacking the next day. We want to finish dinner. And I want all athletes to finish dinner being like, I want to run tomorrow right after they finish, even if they didn't feel like that before because they were a little bit tired.
And logistically in our household, that does involve a lot of DoorDash. And we have places, we have like different places from Boulder that we DoorDash from. And sometimes I feel guilty about that because I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm not fulfilling my wifely duties. And I've just gotten to become better with that over time. It's like, this is just a reality.
Man, cooking is below your pay grade. The hour and a half it takes to cook is just better spent like recovering and working and doing other things. That being
Thank
said,
you. That I makes really, me feel a lot better for DoorDashing.
I really love my fried chicken. And you're not frying me chicken, woman.
Actually, I did kind of notice sometimes that when I was making like lentil pasta or pizzas or whatever, you would kind of disappointed like, oh, but I thought it was a DoorDash night. And it was because you love your DoorDash.
Well, that's actually one hard thing is like cooking for me. Sometimes I have to consciously think about how I'm going to add calories to it. Like, whereas when you eat out, usually if you order freely, you don't have those problems because they're doing that for you. But like if you're cooking for yourself, make sure you're putting a lot of oil in, using any opportunity you can to put in good energy dense, nutrients, because, you know, it's sometimes really easy to be like, oh, well, this is vegetables. This is a stir fry. This is the thing that you look back and you're like, this isn't going to fuel my run the next day like I need it to. And then the final thing is we almost always go in for a pre-bed nibble of something. We always almost eat something before bed.
Recently, so I stopped eating like traditional ice cream with this, the anti-inflammatory stuff, but I love avocado-based ice cream, banana-based ice cream. There's people are getting creative out there with ice cream and it's delicious.
Manatee-based ice cream, sex zebra-based ice cream, so much going on. But basically there, we're just eating something fun. And you put that all together, we have no idea how many calories we have per day. All I know is that it is a metric fuck ton. And we're doing that because we're training hard. And, you know, even in our background, like pulses of low level training, we're still wanting to wake up ready to run the next day. And remember that when you're fueling, it's not about like, oh, I'm comparing myself to the person next door that goes for a walk with their dog. It's like, no, I'm bombing down mountains and trying to push my body to its limits. And in that context, I need to make sure I throw fuel on the fire.
And I think as much as possible, athletes often have different perspectives on this, but making that process fun, like making it a party, making it just something that you look forward to is pretty awesome. Like when you think about it, how many times you get to eat throughout the day, like, that's a gift. We often comment that like, oh my gosh, we get a meal in 3 hours, another 3 hours, this is great.
We'll often be at dinner and still eating dinner and be like, what's for dinner tomorrow night? But if it's not fun for you, that's okay too. Like, we joke around a lot about this, but this is a hard process that brings in a lot of emotions. So wherever you're at, you are loved and you are enough. And just make sure that you're not like projecting parts of like, you know, your history or whatever onto fueling practices that can have really negative impacts on your overall health. So that's where fueling a lot comes in, working with an expert and really just embodying love in the eating process.
Thank you for adding that extra point. I think that's so key. Do you want to transition to Listener Corner as our final topic?
Do it.
I love Listener Corner. We got some good ones this week. Yes. Actually, after the Science Corner episode, just really grateful for people's outreach and thoughts. It was meaningful.
It was so cool. Do you want to read the first one or should I?
I can read the first one.
Go for it.
So this is called Love from B plus H. Our names are B plus H and we are in college. We started running together right before the pandemic and were then sent home for many months. Our running paths diverged for a short bit, but then reunited last fall. We began exploring trails and falling in love with trail running and making running a lifestyle and not just an occasional hobby. We went different ways for spring semester, but discovered your podcast around that time. It became a really awesome way for us two running buddies to stay in contact and be invested in each other's journey without being in the same physical location. Mm. And then the next part, for B, your constant reminders about eating enough food and that eating food can be and is joyous helped her avoid running injury while training. Your positive talk surrounding the importance of mental health was also the final cue that got her to start seeing her therapist. So thank you. And you two were the voice in her ears while training and crushing her first 50K. Woohoo!
Woo!
Kudos to B. And then for H, you helped her find the confidence to identify as a runner. Your open and frank conversations about imposter syndrome have helped her realize she's capable of so many more things than she thought and helped her grow her self-esteem so much from that. Also, the Swap podcast powered her through many a day and helped her run her first 30K. Woohoo!
Woohoo!
From both of us, the most sincerest gratitude and the highest level of appreciation. Listening to your podcast has changed more than just our running lives. The Addy energy has shown us the power of puppy love and enthusiasm. Listening to your podcast makes us want to be better trail runners, but mostly makes us want to be better humans. So thank you for always showing up authentically and becoming our favorite role models. Hugs on hugs on hugs. And then P.S. A few tears may have been shed in the writing of this email. And I would like to add a few tears may have been shed in the reading of that email. Very grateful to B&H. That was such a heartfelt email. And love just how they've explored the running journey together, going through college, especially going through college during COVID can be a tough time. And having this connection via trail running that's awesome.
Well, what I love is they're putting themselves out there in everything. How badass is that? And that's like what we were talking about with confidence in the imposter syndrome. So you put yourself out there not to succeed, but to learn. I am so inspired by that message of just being like, hell yeah, get vulnerable, make jokes that you don't understand. Like try to run 50Ks, try to go hard in training and like have those oops moments and see what happens on the other side, because that's like the magic of life. I love it so much.
A big giant woohoo to B&H. Thank you.
Yes. And then from Jay on fueling celebration. I just wanted to say thanks to you and Megan for your Science Corner episode this week. I spent much of my 20s training for marathons and trying to maintain a caloric deficit every day. I thought later was faster. As a result, I developed iron deficient anemia and low testosterone, as well as a really unhealthy relationship with food and exercise. I've since seen a nutritionist and a therapist who have helped me recover, but I'm still dealing with some of the ramifications and will always be in recovery. As a side note, everyone out there, like it's okay to always be in recovery, and that is a lifelong process that can be beautiful and meaningful. And to continue, I wish I'd listened to this podcast episode back in my 20s. It's so important to raise awareness of what overtraining/underfueling can do to your body, emphasize the importance of eating like a boss, and encourage those that are struggling to seek help and remind them that they are not alone. One thing I'd like to add as a piece of advice to endurance athletes: eat like a boss, even on your rest/easy days, especially on those days. I would just dig myself into a deeper hole on those days instead of recovering and refilling the tank like I know I should have. Thanks again. Y'all are awesome and have some dope ass adventures this weekend. And we did. So thank you. And I think that's actually a really important point. Rest days, part of the reason is that we are such huge fans is that is a time where you can refill the tanks. And it's like, you know, like we talked about, dinner is insurance. Rest days are insurance for your food. So, you know, definitely always keep fueling. Don't play the game of counting calories all the time unless a nutritionist tells you, because often those calorie count games aren't like a specific set science. And that's actually a point I wanted to make. Like it's probably over time a range, right? It's not about like, oh, do I hit that number today? Or do I go 1,000 over today or even under? Like that'll all smooth out over time as long as you're trying to fuel enough always, including rest days.
I'm so glad Jay brought up this point. Also, it makes me think about the idea, the cereal story that I shared in terms of like emptying most of a box of cereal was on a rest day.
That's true.
So yeah, that did happen. And then our final listener corner is from Jay. It's called Trail Celebration. Greetings and salutations. Let me start by saying I think you're both awesome. My friends and I were hiking the Walker Ranch Loop Saturday morning, and both times you passed us, your greetings were so positive and encouraging. That of itself would have been a wonderful thing. However, it does get better. After you passed, I turned to my friends and said, they look familiar. after you passed this the second time, I said, I know where I know them from. They have a podcast called Swap. I then explained to my friends about Swap and how incredibly happy and joyful you both are on your podcast. That means That's so much. Cool. Also, I was a little bit in the struggle bus on at Walker Ranch, and I'm pretty sure I know exactly who these hikers were. And they were just a light of life out there on the trails.
Yeah, maybe. I think you were being so kind to everyone. That could be anyone. But yeah, if you ever see us out there, give us a big old woohoo and maybe even a hug if we're in that place. Because that's what we want to do for you all. Even if we never see you on the trails, we appreciate you so much. We have so much love for you and your whole journey, including all those oops along the way. So thank you all. Rate, review, subscribe, do whatever you do to podcast. Share it with your friends too, if you really like it. We are your biggest fans.
You all are the best. Thank you.
Woo-hoo!
Woo. Bye.